You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
It's to disaster aid for California. What does a Republican Congress want to demand from a blue state? We talk with Senator Ron Johnson on Morning Edition from NPR News. An AI company faces a threat from a source of raw material. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. ChatGPT scrapes information from the internet. The New York Times sued, saying the chatbot regurgitated its articles without permission. Also, a new president prepares to take charge of the border just as border crossings have gone way down. It's Wednesday, January 15th. This day in 2009, a U.S. Airways jet struck a flock of birds and lost both engines after takeoff. Captain Sully Sullenberger landed the plane safely in the Hudson River. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several of President-elect Trump's nominees for cabinet positions are going to Senate confirmation hearings today. That includes former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports she is Trump's pick for U.S. Attorney General.
Bondi worked for nearly two decades as a local prosecutor in Florida before serving as the state's attorney general from 2011 to 2019. She also has deep ties to the president-elect. She served as a personal attorney to Trump during his first impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate and publicly pushed false claims of vote fraud in the 2020 election. She also says Trump was unfairly prosecuted after he left office and that the individuals who prosecuted Trump will be prosecuted themselves. Democrats are expected to question Bondi about whether she will use the Justice Department's powers to act on Trump's stated desire to go after his perceived political enemies. Republicans, though, have voiced strong support for Bondi, and she is expected to win confirmation. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Other nominees in Senate hearings today include Florida Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, former Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe to head the CIA, and former Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy to run the Transportation Department. Fossil fuel executive Chris Wright's confirmation hearing for Energy Secretary is also set for today. Weather forecasters are warning of high winds in Los Angeles later this morning. At least 25 people have been killed by the Los Angeles firestorm since last week. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Los Angeles. Fire crews and regional officials are struggling to cope.
The two big fires, Palisades and Eaton, have destroyed or damaged thousands of homes, putting a huge strain on the Los Angeles housing market. Mayor Karen Bass has issued an emergency order, which she says she hopes will free up 1,200 housing units in the next week or so. But she and other local leaders are also calling on landlords not to jack up prices.
The rents are too expensive to begin with. And the idea that somebody would gouge folks at this point in time, I think, is shameful.
State law prohibits increases of more than 10% during declared emergencies such as this, but that has not stopped bidding wars over some available housing. Martin Costi, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Impeached South Korean President Yoon Song-yeol is being detained by police in Seoul. He's being questioned about why he imposed martial law last month. A South Korean court will decide Yoon's political future. But NPR's Anthony Kuhn says the South Korean president is speaking out against his criminal arrest.
Yoon himself said that the rule of law is now breaking down in South Korea. He says the arrest procedure was invalid, but he voluntarily went in for questioning in order to prevent bloodshed. By contrast, the opposition's parliamentary floor leader said Yoon's arrest is the first step towards restoring the rule of law.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting. You're listening to NPR. Negotiators in Qatar are trying to iron out last-minute differences for a Gaza ceasefire. U.S. and Israeli officials say Hamas is holding this up. A Hamas source says the militants want guarantees that Israel will pull out of Gaza within a specified time frame. President Biden will deliver a farewell speech to Americans from the Oval Office tonight. Earlier this week, the president gave a last major speech on foreign policy from the State Department. Biden has also sought to discuss highlights from his presidency. The private company SpaceX has been busy. The company sent two robotic landers on their way to the moon overnight. Now it's preparing for another Starship test flight later today. NPR's Giles Snyder has more.
The Starship flight is set to launch from SpaceX's facility in South Texas. It will be Starship's seventh test flight since 2023, as SpaceX sets its sights on developing a vehicle capable of carrying people to Mars. The flight is expected to last just over an hour and will feature another attempt to catch the huge, super-heavy booster back at the South Texas launch site, as the company did back in October for the first time. At NASA's Kennedy Space Center overnight, SpaceX launched a double moonshot, sending two lunar landers into space, one for the Japanese company iSpace and another for the Texas-based space company Firefly. The two landers may have shared a ride into space, but they will take separate paths on the journey to the moon. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
I'm Adam Verrier, host of Outdoor Explorer. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1. Connecting Alaskans, life informed.
On the next Alaska News Nightly, state transportation officials examine how to reduce crashes with wildlife.
Use this grant opportunity to actually find out maybe where the best spot for a wildlife crossing would be, or is a wildlife crossing even the right mitigation strategy for these crashes?
That's on Alaska News Nightly, weeknights at 6 p.m. on FM 91.1, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out alaskapublic.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, when Congress votes on disaster aid for California, should they add conditions? We'll talk with Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
First, though, six of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees face confirmation hearings today on Capitol Hill. Senate Majority Whip John Barrasso, the number two Republican, says he expects swift approval and cooperation from Democrats.
Americans now have chosen a new direction. They chose this president, and the president's victory was decisive.
NPR political correspondent Susan Davis joins us now to discuss. Hey, Sue.
Hey, Leila.
So before we get into hearings that are ahead today, what were the big takeaways from yesterday's hearing with Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, Pete Hegseth?
It was certainly contentious at times under questioning from Democrats, particularly about his character and his qualification for the job. But Republicans were pleased with his performance. And after the hearing, he earned the public support of Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst, herself a military veteran. And she was one senator who had previously expressed some hesitation about the nomination. That tells me he's pretty confidently headed towards confirmation, although he might not be ready for day one, as President Trump would like. But it seems like it's a matter of when and not if.
It's interesting because he's seen as among the more controversial Trump picks, given his past comments on things like women serving in combat and the allegation of sexual assault, which he's denied. What did his hearing show about the path to confirmation for Trump's nominees? Will they be easy, as Senator Barrasso is calling for?
For some, they certainly will. At the top of that list, I would probably put Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He's Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. He's well-known, he's vetted, he's well-liked. He's poised to be confirmed on day one. Expect a big bipartisan vote for him. Mm-hmm. I'd also put former Congressman Sean Duffy in that group. He's Trump's nominee for Transportation Secretary. He also seems to be on a glide path to confirmation and is also really well-liked. I also can't help but noting, Leila, that he's an alum of the MTV reality series Road Rules, and his job will be helping determine the rules for the road. It is just too good to let that slide.
Okay, and which nominees could get a little more pushback from senators?
I think the most closely watched today is probably going to be the Senate Judiciary Committee for Pam Bondi to be Trump's attorney general. She's obviously going to have a much easier path ahead than Trump's first nominee for the job, former Congressman Matt Gaetz, who had to step down. She brings much more qualification to the job. She's a former prosecutor. She's a former attorney general for the state of Florida. But she's also one of the nominees that's going to face some of the toughest questioning from Democrats. She's a longtime Trump loyalist. She's represented him in a personal capacity. So she's going to face questions about her fidelity to the law over fidelity to Trump, as well as her role in helping Trump try to undermine the 2020 election.
Now, it's rare for the Senate to not confirm presidential picks. Do you expect all these nominees to get a green light in the end?
That seems most likely, and for a couple of reasons. Senators generally believe a president deserves to have the cabinet that they want. Second, Senate rules have changed. They only need a simple majority to confirm these, and Republicans have 53 votes. So these hearings are really less about winning over Democrats and more about keeping Republicans unified. And there isn't much political interest in opposing the president, particularly as conservative groups say they could threaten a primary against any Republican senator who does.
That's NPR political correspondent Susan Davis. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
President Biden has promised the federal government will do anything and everything, his words, to help Southern California recover from fires. And the outgoing administration has committed resources even as the fires burn. Sending additional help over time would require an act of Congress, which has the power of the purse. And in Congress, some Republicans who have the majority say they want to add conditions to any aid. House Speaker Mike Johnson is among those who said that probably should happen. And we have called another Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who is also talking about conditions to aid to California. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Hope you're doing well.
Doing well, and I hope you are as well. I guess there are two parts to this. One is what policy changes you would want. But before that, it seems to me there's the question of whether you want to use people in distress as leverage, whether you want to say, I'm not going to help you unless you agree to my policy change. What do you think about that?
I think you first have to consider the economic concept of moral hazard. And I think what has happened over the decades here with federal disaster relief is that more and more individuals, more and more states are just relying on the federal government when something happens, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's fire, you know, some other natural disaster, that the federal government just come in and bail them out. And the result of this is they pass laws where they've made it very unattractive for private insurers to come in and actually insure properties and assess the risk properly. Mm-hmm. They've encouraged people to build, you know, multi-million, billion-dollar homes and complexes in very vulnerable areas. And they haven't taken the mitigation steps, for example, in California from the standpoint of wildfire, as they have in the past. Interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. California used to have 4.5 million acres per year burn. This is back in early 1900s.
Yeah.
Then they took mitigation efforts. They allowed, you know, sheep and cattle to graze to keep down the brush. They got rid, you know, they put fire breaks. They auctioned off forests, and that dropped it down to 250,000 acres a year on average. They're back up to 4.5 million because of very bad policy. So, you can't keep bailing people out and let them assume more and more risk.
There is a ton to talk about here in policy, which I want to get to. But just to get politics off the table, Senator, you mentioned hurricanes. Would your opinion be exactly the same if we were talking about a hurricane in Florida, which is becoming a red state, as opposed to California, which is a blue state?
No, again, I generally vote against these disaster relief packages.
Wait, would your opinion would be the same regardless of the state? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Again, we have to stop creating moral hazard. We have to get people to assess and take on the risk themselves, as opposed to just transfer it to the federal government all the time. Again, this is people build in flood zones. People build very expensive structures that aren't properly protected that are vulnerable to some of these dangers as well. So, again, we are creating moral hazard after moral hazard, and the problem is increasing rather than decreasing.
Well, it raises a big question, Senator, because we're talking about climate change, climate-related disasters, fires, hurricanes, and so forth, and we're discovering that not just Florida, but North Carolina is in a hurricane zone. and that the fire season in California is not a few months. It's almost the entire year and almost the whole state. In fact, there are wildfires in other parts of the country. Just a few weeks ago, I was on a train that was canceled because there was a wildfire on the tracks. And this was in Connecticut, the border between Connecticut and New York State. So this is everywhere. And if that is our starting point, and then we focus back in on California and the danger of wildfires. What is it that you want California to do to make themselves more resilient in future disasters or future fires?
Take a look at what they did when they reduced the average number of acres burned every year from 4.5 million to 250,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, take a look at what they did there. Again, they allowed sheep and cattle to graze. They auctioned off forests to be logged so they could thin it out, so create fire breaks. You know, then the environmentalists took over, and they stopped doing all those very common sense mitigation efforts. And now politicians are blaming climate change, like mankind can actually change climate. Like we can prevent climate. We can't. The climate has always changed, always will. We can adapt to it, and we can mitigate it. They stopped mitigating it, which is why they're back up to 4.5 million acres burning every year in California. It's just stupid policy, and they won't admit it.
We'll just note, I mean, there's all the science on climate change and human-caused climate change. I think you're saying that you don't accept that or don't accept that as the main thing
corrupted.
Happening. Okay.
It's corrupted science.
Okay, understood. If we talk about this particular situation, it seems to me that there are some specific things that can do that aren't even that expensive. You can fireproof houses. You can move vegetation even a few feet away from houses makes a difference. But you have a situation where people build homes in areas that are also forested, that also have grasslands, that also are nature, and it's going to be dry, and it's getting drier and drier. Are there specific things then that you would call for Californians to do in terms of building codes, in terms of the way that they put communities together, or is it simply a matter, as you say, of sending out sheep to graze?
Well, listen, I do think that tile roofs are probably better than cedar shake roofs. I mean, that's pretty obvious. It's been obvious for decades. Those homes are probably less likely to start on fire when, you know, these sparks and timbers fly literally miles, you know, in 100-mile-an-hour winds. So, yeah, I mean, take a look at what actually causes this and, you know, soberly assess what you need to do. But, again, go back to what they did when they dramatically reduced the number of acres in uncontrolled fires. I mean, they know how to do this. They just refuse to do it.
Do you think that it is Congress's place to instruct them as to what to do on a state and local level with forest management, with building codes, with whatever it might be?
Yeah, if they're asking for American taxpayer dollars to fund their mismanagement, absolutely we should have the role of telling them what they need to do if they want the dollars. That makes common sense. Otherwise, California, again, they made the mistake. They're the ones that assumed the risk. They're the ones that made the stupid decisions in mismanagement. They got a lot of revenue. They just misspend it all the time. Okay?
And if you do not get the changes that you would like, you would say, Californians, you're on your own. The federal government, the United States of America, is not going to help you. You're out.
That's what I would do.
And you would do that regardless of the state, even if it was a disaster in Wisconsin, which is not impossible to imagine.
Well, good news is Wisconsin... We're not really subject to these types of dangers, and we actually do conduct forestry, and we try and manage our forests as best as possible.
You got a lot of
state and county owned as opposed to federal, because we have stupid federal laws.
Got a lot of lakes as well. Senator, thanks so much. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Have a great day.
Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Lori Townsend, news director and host of Talk of Alaska. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
The Eagle River Nature Center opened in 1996 and has served as a gateway to the Chugach State Park ever since. On the next Outdoor Explorer, host Paul Twardock visits the center and talks to staff and volunteers about its history, facilities, trails, and programs. Join them this Thursday at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, or alaskapublic.org.
Hey, this is Jeff Guo with Planet Money, which finds creative, entertaining stories that explain the big, complicated forces that move the economy and shape your life. Combined with local programs like the Alaska Economic Report, the partnership between NPR and Alaska Public Media works to make sense of the market, from a food stand at the Alaska State Fair to the hallways of the Federal Reserve. Learn more by visiting alaskapublic.org/donate.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We do not yet know exactly how President-elect Trump will enact a promise to close the border on day one, but we can take a snapshot of the U.S.-Mexico border as Trump prepares to take office. And that view reveals something a little surprising. Unlike a year ago when a surge of migrants was peaking, today border crossings are down dramatically. NPR's Jasmine Garst begins her look at the border with a woman hoping to cross.
It's noon in Tijuana, Mexico. The sun is barreling down, and in the shade, a woman with a tired gaze is rocking her child to sleep. Cindy Alamy is from Colombia. She and her husband owned a small store there.
Entonces nos dijeron que si no pagábamos, nos matan a la familia.
She says the local gang extorted them, said, pay or we kill your family. So they headed north.
La primera intención de nosotros cuando llegamos aquí era pasar por Coyote.
The plan was to hire a coyote, that's a smuggler, to get them over the U.S. border. They found one who said he'd charge $8,000 for the three of them. But people at the Tijuana shelter warned them not to attempt to cross the border that way.
Porque puede ser que te maten, o puede ser que te devuelvan para tu país.
You could get killed. If you get caught, you could get sent back to Colombia. They were encouraged to instead try getting an appointment using CBP One. That's the U.S. Customs and Border Protection app to legally request entry into the U.S. They've been here in Tijuana at a migrant shelter trying to get that appointment for 5 months.
Sí, porque imagínese ya viene 20 enero y no sabemos qué va a pasar.
January 20th is almost here, she says, when President Trump takes office. He's vowed to shut down the CBP One program and reinforce the border, which these days looks pretty quiet. According to the CBP, in the last 6 months, apprehensions decreased by more than 70%. That's due to a combination of executive orders by President Biden last summer and the Mexican National Guard cracking down on migrants heading to the U.S. At the Juventud 2000 migrant shelter in Tijuana, director Jose Maria Garcia Lara says for months now, the number of people showing up has gone down. What's happening is they're staying away from shelters, NGOs, and official help centers.
Esta comunidad se está invisibilizando, pero sigue llegando mucha comunidad a las ciudades fronterizas.
Instead, they're moving underground, hiring coyotes to cross them over the border and go undetected. In her spot under the shade, Alamy says she's tempted to do the same.
Sí, imagínese, uno era la tentación pasar, pero no.
But now, the coyote has nearly doubled his price, from $8,000 to $15,000. Undocumented immigration is a business, and right now, business is booming. I meet Samuel at dusk. He won't tell me his last name because his work is illegal. He's a coyote. He says crossings cost between $9,000 and $12,000 for a family.
Caminando por extensos territorios del desierto.
These days, coyotes are crossing through deeper parts of the desert, dangerous terrain, to avoid increased patrols by the Mexican National Guard and U.S. Border Patrol. When asked if a Trump administration will hurt business, Samuel scoffs.
Que ponga muro, que lo que tenga, pero...
Put up a wall, but you better make sure it covers the sky, because there's no such thing as a problem for us. Like a mouse, we will find a hole. Several miles up on the San Diego side of the border, Kate Monroe envisions a very different future, one with an impenetrable border. She's the founder of Border Vets, a group of former military that advocate for stronger borders. We're driving through the Jacumba Wilderness alongside the border wall.
Up until just a few months ago, you would see 500 to 1,000 people a day crossing in every single hole along this border in broad daylight, and nobody stopping them or deterring them from coming over.
For the last 6 months or so, it's been pretty deserted. Where there used to be these massive open-air detention camps, there's nothing but dirt now. Her hope is President Trump will take it further, meaning give more resources to Border Patrol, deport immigrants who have criminal records en masse, and finish the wall.
That way we have said, and we have been very clear on, we drew a line in the sand, do not cross this wall.
She says just because she's passionate about this doesn't mean she doesn't have empathy for migrants. Quite the contrary. Monroe ended her military career after a brutal sexual assault. She says she hears migrant women talk about being raped while en route to the U.S., and it crushes her. She'd like to see immigration reform that provides alternatives to people from all over the world trekking across Latin America, hoping to cross that border.
All these jobs we say Americans don't want, well, then we need to make a better plan in a way that doesn't get them assaulted, robbed, and killed on the way here.
As we talk, we see a family walking by the border wall. They've just crossed. They're the first migrants I've seen out here in 3 days. Monroe gives them water. Their daughters, 4 and 11, start crying. Their puffy winter jackets are covered in desert dust. Dad, Ronald, hugs them. We made it, Ronald tells them. We're in a safe place now. They've been traveling for a month. They're from Venezuela. They got too scared to wait in Mexico, so they paid a coyote to bring them over.
Somos para ellos simplemente un objeto de valor comercial.
To them, Ronald says, we are nothing but merchandise. Border Patrol agents whisk them away before they give us their last name or the rest of their story. This, Monroe says, is what she also means by securing the border and revamping the immigration system.
It's a very sad situation that they find themselves in because we need labor. Is this what? That does not look like compassion to me.
In a matter of seconds, the patrol car takes them away, leaving us behind in a cloud of dirt. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, California.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Elon Musk helped President-elect Trump return to the White House. Now, car safety advocates are worried that Musk will influence federal agencies regulating businesses like Tesla.
Tesla has been overselling the effectiveness of its technology for years. And a lot of people buy into that because it's tweeted about that way.
The fight over crash reporting requirements on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This morning at 9 on FM 91.1.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities in Southern California are warning of dangerous fire conditions today. Santa Ana winds in and around Los Angeles are expected to gust up to 50 to 60 miles per hour. Six of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks will be on Capitol Hill today for their Senate confirmation hearings. They include Pam Bondi to serve as the country's attorney general. Bondi is a former attorney general of Florida. Also testifying will be Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Trump's choice to serve as Secretary of State, as NPR's Claudia Grisales reports.
Rubio told NPR he's looking forward to making his case before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
My job is to execute the president's foreign policy, and that's what we're going to do, and with the interests of America, first and foremost.
Against a slate of more controversial nominees, Rubio has drawn unique bipartisan support for the role under Donald Trump. The former Florida House Speaker was elected to the Senate in 2010 and later became the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He launched a fail bid for the presidency in 2016, losing out to Trump after a series of attacks, but later the two became allies. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
This is NPR News. The Labor Department says consumer prices in the U.S. were up 2.9% in December compared to the same month 1 year ago. It marks the highest annual pace of inflation since last July. It also shows inflation in the economy remains above the Fed's annual target of 2%. The cost of gasoline and food went up during the month. The Securities and Exchange Commission is suing Elon Musk. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the lawsuit accuses Musk of shortchanging investors during his takeover of the site formerly known as Twitter.
Security regulators say when Musk was acquiring stock before he bought the platform now known as X, he was 11 days late in disclosing his stock purchases. Regulators say that delay effectively meant Musk bought stock at a discount and ripped off investors by more than $150 million. In a statement, Musk lawyer Alex Spiro says, quote, as the SEC retreats and leaves office, the SEC's multi-year campaign of harassment against Mr. Musk culminated in the filing of a single-count ticky-tack complaint. Musk, a close advisor to President-elect Donald Trump, is expected to attend Trump's inauguration on Monday. That will be when SEC Chair Gary Gensler steps down. This marks the third time Gensler's SEC has taken Musk to court. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Stocks are higher on Wall Street. The Dow is up 569 points, or more than 1%. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
What does the future hold for the Anchorage economy? Join the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation for their upcoming luncheon on January 22nd at the Denina Center. AEDC will share an economic forecast for 2025 that draws on brand new economic research and will also provide updates on advancements with the Choose Anchorage initiative. Keynote speaker Peter Kageyama will remind the community of small steps to enhance livability and ensure Anchorage is a lovable city. Tickets at aedcweb.com. This message sponsored by AEDC.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. If you should ask ChatGPT a question, the answer from that chatbot on the internet may include information first reported by the New York Times. The Times says it never gave ChatGPT or its maker OpenAI permission to do this. So the newspaper and other publishers sued OpenAI for copyright infringement. The case may depend on a hearing that happened yesterday in New York, which NPR's Bobby Allen was covering. Hey there, Bobby.
Good morning, Steve.
What was it like in court yesterday?
Well, it's pretty contentious. Both sides were arguing before a federal judge about whether this case should move to trial or be dismissed. And the judge didn't rule right away. He said he will rule soon. And as you mentioned, this is a copyright case, so pretty wonky. The details get pretty dense, but it boils down to this. Was it legal for OpenAI to feed ChatGPT the Times digital archive as it was scanning the entire internet? And the Times says absolutely not. Lawyers for the paper say they never approved it, they never paid for it, and they say they have examples of the chatbot reproducing verbatim Times articles.
Yeah, they write the first few words of the article in a prompt, as they say, and the entire article comes back except without attribution to the Times or paying the Times. So how did ChatGPT's owner respond?
Yeah, OpenAI's legal team told the judge that ChatGPT isn't a document retrieval system. It's a large language model, meaning it's not made to spit out entire Times articles, and that the Times was only able to get ChatGPT to do this after asking it thousands of different questions.
They're not denying that they use New York Times articles, but they're saying they didn't use the exact thing always, and that it's legal. How can that be?
Well, OpenAI says the mass scraping of text from all corners of the internet in order to give ChatGPT an enormous trove of data was done under something called the Fair Use Doctrine. And it's a legal principle that says a copyright work can be used without permission for things like research, education, commentary, journalism, like we're doing right here.
Yeah.
But it cannot be used in a way where it ends up competing with the original. And it has to be transformative, meaning it's got to be made into something new. And OpenAI says fair use is a shield that should protect it from this and all copyright lawsuits. But the Times says no way. We should note here that other publishers, including the New York Daily News and the Center for Investigative Reporting, have also joined this litigation with the Times. And Microsoft is also being sued here since it incorporated ChatGPT into its Bing search engine.
Okay, you've given us an idea of the arguments. What's at stake here, both for publishers and for AI makers?
Yeah, quite a lot. The news business has been threatened by AI tools, particularly chatbots and so-called answer engines that extract information from articles and synthesize it at lightning speed. And of course, the fear is for the news industry is that people will no longer visit publishers' websites like nytimes.com if you can get it faster from an AI tool like ChatGPT. And of course, that could quickly hurt a publisher's bottom line. And for AI companies, Steve, this is huge because it will be the first test of whether the mass scraping these firms did was legal or not. The whole industry has basically been operating under this principle that fair use protects them. And if that is wrong, well, it could really open the floodgates to more suits coming after popular AI chatbots. And there are many out there. Now, in the Times case, Steve, the most dramatic outcome here is the judge ordering that OpenAI destroy its entire data set.
Wow.
The Times has asked for that.
NPR's Bobby Allen, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Today, senators will hold a confirmation hearing for their own colleague, Florida Republican Marco Rubio. He's President-elect Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. Rubio would be the country's first Latino in the role, if confirmed, since its creation more than 200 years ago. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales reports.
More than 25 years ago, law school graduate Marco Rubio paid a cold call visit to the home of a legendary political figure in West Miami. Rubio had worked for a who's who in Florida politics, but was ready to make his own bid as a city commissioner.
He says, "My name is Marco Rubio, and I want to run for office. Will you help me?"
That's former West Miami Mayor Rebecca Sosa, who was immediately impressed.
And after I spoke to him the next day, we were walking door to door.
Rubio won that election 2 months later, starting on a path that took him to the Florida House and in 2011, the U.S. Senate.
That was no surprise to Florida Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, who ran in similar political circles with Rubio.
The first time I ever saw him, he gave a speech, and after that speech, I went to my campaign manager and I said, he has it. It.
But not everyone agreed that Rubio had it. Critics panned his disastrous, rigid performance in a presidential debate in 2016 that earned him the nickname Marco Bot. President-elect Donald Trump, on his way to winning his first election to the White House, took aim at Rubio.
They hate little Marco Rubio so much.
It's true.
However, supporters say what the public did not see behind the scenes was Rubio putting aside the attacks, shaking hands with Trump, and making him an unlikely ally.
Yeah, that's right. He was smart enough to know that all that stuff was politics.
Now, Jimenez says there won't be much daylight between the two when it comes to foreign diplomacy. He and others argue Rubio's charisma, wicked sense of humor, competitiveness, and humble beginnings are what fuel his approach to politics. Here's the dean of the Florida congressional delegation, Republican Mario Diaz-Balart.
His father was a bartender. His mother was a maid. And they taught him the value of hard work, of patriotism.
The two served alongside each other in the Florida State House. Diaz-Balart also says Rubio's identity as husband and father of four is core to his approach to politics.
Marco Rubio not only exemplifies the American dream, I would tell you that he exemplifies the Republican Party.
Allies say Rubio's competitiveness and drive are rooted in early dreams of playing professional football. They connected that background to the way he works as a senator, like his aggressive stance against dictators in Latin America and taking China and Iran to task. Rubio, while rushing to the Senate to vote on legislation, laughed off the death threats he received in 2017 over his criticism of the Venezuelan regime. But he gets quite serious when asked about his next potential role.
My job is to execute the president's foreign policy, and that's what we're going to do, and with the interests of America, first and foremost.
As a Cuban-American, allies argue he'll pay attention to the Western Hemisphere in ways that hasn't happened before. Even some Democrats are excited about his nomination, like former Senate Intelligence Chairman Mark Warner.
We don't always agree, but I think he understands the importance of American leadership in the world. I think he's thoughtful, and I look forward to supporting him.
As the Senate considers a slate of controversial Trump nominees, Rubio's bipartisan support makes him stand out as an exception. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR News.
Would you be a good dead spider and grab that for me? This is Sandra Tsing Lo with the lowdown on science. How come when spiders die, their legs curl up all nasty? Ask Tae-Fei Yap and team from Rice University. They learned that spiders don't use muscles to extend their legs. It's fluid from their circulatory system. When they die, pressure is lost and their legs curl up like a claw. This gave the team an idea. They attached syringes, yes, to dead spiders and pushed fluid in and out. These creepy claws were strong enough to pull wires out of a circuit. The researchers believe they could be used to assemble microelectronics and collect specimens. You know, just in case we ever run out of tweezers.
The Lowdown on Science is a production of University of California, Irvine Science Communication and LAIST 89.3.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA, Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Next week, President-elect Donald Trump will be sworn in at the Capitol in the spot where the worst mayhem of January 6th unfolded. A look at the rewriting of an insurrection next time, here and now.
This morning at 9 on FM 91.1.
the latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. A Wichita, Kansas woman faced a fine for her overgrown lawn. This problem caught the attention of the Lawn Guy, a TikToker who offers landscaping advice. He offered his services, which she described as her prayers being answered, and 83 million views later, comments have flooded in along with contributions. He started a fundraiser bringing in more than $500,000 to take care of continuous landscaping. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. South Korean police today arrested the country's impeached president, Yoon Song-yeol, after a standoff with his security detail.
This is the first time that police there have detained a sitting president. Every word there matters somewhere. Last month, Yoon sparked a crisis when he briefly declared martial law.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn was outside the president's residence this morning, and he joins me now from Seoul. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Leila.
So what's happening at the president's home?
Well, it's been freezing cold the whole time, I can tell you that. Protesters knew this arrest was coming, so many of them had been there before dawn. They were at Yoon's residence, which is on a hillside next to a major street, and there were more than 3,000 police and anti-corruption investigators there to execute an arrest warrant, which is a lot more than their first try. There were also ruling party lawmakers there trying to block police. It got chaotic. There were some tussles, but luckily there was no serious violence.
That's good to hear. You were talking to protesters out there. What'd they say?
Well, today and throughout this crisis, South Korea's vibrant political protest culture has been on full display. People across the political spectrum taking to the streets to defend democracy. Just after Yoon's arrest was announced, the anti-Yoon campaign erupted in cheering. Police were keeping the pro and anti-Yoon camps apart. I spoke to a 24-year-old student named Min So-won, who was both elated and relieved that there was no fighting. Let's hear her now. I was really worried about such a situation, she said. I worried about what would happen if there was gunfire. But I'm so relieved that there was thankfully no such situation and that Yoon Song-yeol is finally detained, although it took a long time. Now, Yoon's supporters, meanwhile, are a minority, but some recent polls show support for his party has increased and support for his impeachment has decreased, which suggests that Yoon is rallying his base.
You know, we mentioned how unprecedented this is, and police did attempt to arrest Yoon before, but his security detail blocked them. What was different this time?
Well, since the last attempt, Yoon's security detail fortified the residence with buses and barbed wire. Police had to scale those buses with ladders to get in. And the presidential security detail had said they'd fight to the finish. But before that, before the arrest, their leaders were charged with obstructing official duties. So in the end, they did not get in the way. There was a standoff as Yoon's lawyers negotiated with authorities. Then he was taken away for questioning. Yoon himself is a prosecutor. He remains silent under questioning. Authorities now have 48 hours to seek a formal arrest warrant for him or release him.
Wow, that's quite dramatic. What's the political significance of this arrest?
The significance is being hotly contested. Yoon himself said that the rule of law is now breaking down in South Korea. He says the arrest procedure was invalid, but he voluntarily went in for questioning in order to prevent bloodshed. By contrast, the opposition's parliamentary floor leader said Yoon's arrest is the first step towards restoring the rule of law. And besides the criminal charges of insurrection, there's also another process going on, which is his impeachment trial at the Constitutional Court. They're going to reconvene for another hearing tomorrow, and if the court rules against him, Yoon will formally be removed from office.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. Thank you so much, Anthony.
You're welcome, Leila.
We'll be right back.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Dr. Justin Clark, host of Line One, Your Health Connection. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1. Connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Responsible for a child that's strong-willed or defiant? Do you find yourself frustrated, angry, and yelling at your children? A parent's relationship with their child has far-reaching impacts on their mental health, and on the next Line One, host Prentice Pemberton and his guest will explore evidence-based solutions for parents caught in the cycle of power struggles and conflict. Join us for a discussion on gentle parenting and transforming relationships. That's Line One, Wednesdays at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 or alaskapublic.org.
Alaska Public Media has expanded our partnership with Alaska Premier Auctions and Appraisals and can now accept donations of art, antiques, and other valuables. Everything from watches and coins to jewelry and precious gems to fine furnishings and even entire estates can potentially be donated to support the programs you love. To learn more, please visit alaskapublic.org/collectibles or get in touch with a local auction service specialist directly at 907-570-7050.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldil. The latest inflation numbers are out this morning. Consumer prices in December rose 2.9% from a year ago, according to data from the Labor Department. It's the third consecutive increase. So how's that impacting prices on store shelves? NPR's Alina Selyuk is here for a reality check. She's been tracking prices at the same Walmart in a suburb of Savannah, Georgia, for about 5 years. Hi, Alina.
Hello, hello.
Okay, so 5 years at the same store. Tell us about your project.
So we have been tracking prices of dozens of products at this very same Walmart. The basket has grown over the years. On my last visit, I shopped 96 items. Did I spend a day and a half zigzagging every aisle of a superstore? Yes, yes, I did. I was recording prices of everything, snacks, shampoo, dog food. The idea is to compare these prices to prices in years past to figure out how those two things can be true at the same time, which is that we hear the rate of inflation has cooled for 2 years. And most of us would probably relate to a skeptical woman I met here named Cicely Gardner.
The meat going up, milk, eggs, most everything going up.
It feels like everything is going up, she says, but it's not. And I have a sense why.
What did you find?
So I'll give you some highlights, and folks can check out a lot of numbers and graphics on npr.org/shopping cart. I have two headlines. First is that compared over 1 year, over the course of 2024, on average, prices on my list rose less than 1%. And that's because exactly half of the items actually did not change in price at all over a year. And that is a really notable shift from recent years. So exactly half the prices did not change. 27 items got more expensive, including ground beef, milk, and of course the eggs because of the avian flu. And 21 items actually got cheaper, including bananas, salmon, and pork chops.
Okay, so what's your second headline? Because so many people get to the checkout counter and they feel like everything's much more expensive when they get that bill.
100%. I think the second headline is the source of this heartburn at the checkout, which is, I think, our brains are stuck on pre-pandemic prices. Mm-hmm. And the five-year view is much more painful. Compared to 2019, prices on my list, on average, rose 25%.
Wow.
Only a handful of items got cheaper, and that includes a screwdriver and shoelaces, which actually dropped in price because they went from being a brand name to a store brand.
Okay, but you can't eat a screwdriver or shoelaces. Is it realistic that prices will ever go back to where people really want them to be?
You know, historically, that just doesn't happen. Most years, prices tick up, and the pandemic shifts were seismic. Walmart, for its part, pointed to 6,000 price decreases it has pushed for. These are rollbacks on some popular items. But it still has to work with manufacturers to do some of that. And when I asked all these brands on my list to explain their price increases, many of them simply said it just costs more to make stuff. You have Jif saying peanuts for peanut butter cost more. Yoplait saying dairy for yogurt costs more. Domino Sugar had this long list of costlier trucking and shipping by sea and by rail, plus rising wages. And American wages, on average, have outpaced inflation for more than a year and a half. And ultimately, if this continues, these are the wage gains that restore our buying power. So as our paychecks adjust, people maybe can better afford the new higher prices.
NPR's Alina Selyukh. Thank you so much, Alina.
Thank you. Thank you.
Some other news we're following. The United States, the Biden administration, says it is removing Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. At the same time, in a deal pushed by Pope Francis, Cuba says it's going to release hundreds of people who were jailed after anti-government protests several years ago. These developments happen just before a change of administration in the United States, which raises the question of whether any of this will last or matter. NPR's Ada Peralta reports.
This latest chapter in U.S.-Cuba relations dates back to the summer of 2021. Thousands of Cubans across many cities took to the streets to protest against the government. The government ended up arresting more than 700 Cubans. Many of them ended up being convicted of everything from public disorder to sedition. At the same time, the Biden administration, which many expected to ease relations with Cuba, ended up leaving most of the sanctions from the Trump administration in place. From Rome, Pope Francis focused on the protesters in jail. And in January of last year, he sent Cardinal Beniamino Stella to Havana.
El Papa desea mucho que haya una respuesta positiva.
The Pope very much wants a positive response, he said at the time. It doesn't matter what the Cuban government wants to call a release, whether amnesty or clemency.
Es importante que los jóvenes que en un momento han manifestado su pensamiento.
What's important, he said, is that the young people who voiced their thoughts can return home. And on Tuesday, the Cuban government said that it would begin releasing 553 prisoners. The Biden administration said to help the Catholic Church, they would drop some sanctions and remove Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The only other countries on the list are Iran, Syria, and North Korea. Cuba's removal from the list would make it easier for foreign companies to do business in Cuba. But John Kavalik, who runs the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council, says all of this is likely to implode as soon as Trump takes office. For Cuba, it's like
they find a winning lottery ticket, and then an hour later, they find out it isn't theirs.
The Trump administration, he says, is already stacked with hardliners, including the Cuban-American Senator Marco Rubio, whom Trump nominated for Secretary of State. So for now, global companies, he says, will likely continue to act as if Cuba remains on the state sponsors of terrorism list.
Because it's easy to return them to it. So why make any changes to your business model that is, by definition, going to be hostage to the unknown?
On Capitol Hill, three Cuban-American members of Congress rejected the Biden administration moves. Representative Mario Diaz-Balart called it, quote, shameful. Representative Maria Elvira Salazar said in less than a week, Trump could change all of it.
So maybe the Cubans will have a very short party.
In a statement, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel said the decision to release prisoners was taken unilaterally. But he did thank those who helped bring an end to the sanctions. Cuba, he said, should never have been on the list. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation. Operate in the Fleets, in Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP 830 AM, Sandpoint, Alaska, and K201DA 88.1 FM, King Cove.
Mm-hmm.
generous Leadership Circle advocates Robert Scher and Carrie Reardon. You are the heart of Alaska Public Media. Thank you for your continued support in bringing quality programming to our listeners.